Well, you heard in our announcements just a minute ago a couple of things about our youth group. Our senior high students are traveling home right now. They're on the road today as they've been in Florida for the last almost 10 days or on the trip for 10 days or so at Big Stuff, this conference that they've been at. And the reason why we do things like this and we send our students all the way down to Florida and we send them with leaders for 10 days is because we're hoping that they will change. If you have teenagers, that's your hope, isn't it? Got a lot of some amens there from the parents of teenagers. I love it. We hope they change. Of course we do, because we hope that they grow. We look at teenagers and we say, well, wherever you're at right now, we love them, we care for them, we hope that they are on an ongoing basis, they're growing, they're changing, they're becoming adults, and there's obvious change in that. And for those of us who are adults, we've all been through that. Hopefully we've had those moments where over time we've seen change in our own lives. That is the goal. We're hoping that today when they come home safely, that maybe in just a couple of small ways, those kids who left 10 days ago come back and they're a little bit different. We send them to these places because we believe that the environments that they'll be put in give them a great chance to learn more about who God is, to learn more about who they are, to grow deeper in their relationship with Him, to grow deeper in their relationship with their leaders, to grow deeper in their relationship with each other, so that they come back and they're just maybe a little bit different. And you heard that we're starting a project in the youth room. You're going to hear about our youth a lot this year because this is something that I believe God's putting on our heart as a church is to invest in that age group, to invest in our teenagers, our junior highs, and our senior highs, and to make sure that they have a place, a community where they can come and where they can grow deeper in their relationship with God. For some of them, to find out for the very first time who God is and how much He loves them and how much He wants to grab hold of their life and transform it and change it. And I believe this is a step in our church that is necessary, one that God is calling us to make sure that not just in the physical space, although that's really important, that's something that we're going to do. We're going to make sure that that room is a place where those students want to be, where it's engaging for them, where they can come together in community. But more than that, to create a spiritual environment where people can come and these youth, these young people can come and to know that they will interact with the living God in this community. And so as we just let you know this morning briefly, we're hoping over the next couple of months we can work on that room. We're setting a target of $6,000 and we've already got three. So again, just encouraging you, if you can, to go above and beyond what you normally give here at Westside, to give to that project so that we can get to work. And we're hoping that even in September as we kick off our new year for youth groups, that we've made a considerable dent in that room so that we can allow our leaders and our community to really rally around our students and to see some incredible life change. Now, when you think about that, and if you're an adult, if you're past the high school age, I want you to think about this. As we think about the next generation, we want them to change. We want them to grow. Are you still willing to take that on for yourself? I think what happens for a lot of us and a lot of people who come to Christianity, come to Jesus, we have these moments in our lives where we see incredible growth and incredible change. And then we have these periods in our lives where it kind of levels off, where we get comfortable, where we're happy, where we're at. Some of us, we have these dynamic stories in our lives, and we look back and we say, man, I was living a destructive life, I was living an unhealthy life, I was living in a place where I was hurting myself, I was hurting other people, where I felt far from God. And then we some of us can tell the story where God grabbed a hold of our lives, and we say, and then there was this huge change, a miraculous change in my life. I became a totally different people. God's love and His grace just grabbed a hold of me in a way that I would say, I'm totally different. Those are amazing stories. Maybe some of our stories are more dramatic. Some of them seem less dramatic, but maybe they're not. They're just as powerful. But then I wonder if some of us get stuck in those other zones where we just kind of plateau and we're happy with where we're at. You know, we overcame at some point in our life these really big things, these really obvious things in our life that we knew we needed to change. But recently, our lives look kind of the same as they did last month, last year, the last decade. We get comfortable with who we are and where we're at. We've overcome things that we might say, those were big, obvious sins. But maybe there's little things, or things that we think are little, that kind of continue our life that, oh, maybe that shouldn't be there, but we've sort of become comfortable having them as a part of our life. They become part of the background. Today, I want to challenge you to do something really hard. I want to challenge you to take a significant step in changing your life. And here's why. Because if you won't change, then you can't grow. That's just how life works. That's just a basic principle. If you want your life to be different, if you want to be a different person, a better person, a deeper person, a more authentic person, if you really want to grow, you need to be willing to change. And if you won't change, if you sit here and say, I'm good where I'm at. I don't really want to ruffle the feathers. I don't really want to get into it. That seems hard. If you won't change, then you just need to know that you can't grow. And here's what's really challenging. For most people, change is really threatening to our lives. We get comfortable with where we're at. Change is tough. That's a fact of life. Almost everybody would agree. Man, it would just change externally is tough. What I mean by that is when your circumstances change, that can be really tough. When you think about changing, for example, your job or your relationship status or where you live or what you do with your time, those things are all threatening to us. We like our routines. We like where we're at. We feel a certain amount of security around how things are. And so change can be really hard. Today, I'm actually going to ask you to consider to do something that's even tougher than changing your circumstances or the externals in your life. I'm asking you to consider making a change that's internal. And this is even tougher because as hard as it is to change some of the things that we do or some of our circumstances, changing who we are goes right down to the core of who we are. It's an identity thing. So are you up for that? I get it. It's kind of threatening. But if you won't change, you can't grow. And so if you sit here and think, man, one day I would love to be a different person. I would love to be a person that has more integrity, a person who has more self-control, a person who's more loving, a person who has better relationships. I want my marriage to get better. I want to be a better parent. I want to be a better friend. I want to have deeper relationships. If you want some of those things, if you want to grow in your life, you need to be willing to change. So I'm asking you today, what I'm going to ask as we work through the material we're working through today is to consider making one really big step in your life that moves towards change so that by God's grace and power, you can grow. And over time, maybe it's a month, a year, 10 years, you can look back and say, man, once again, God did something incredible in my life. I'm not who I was before that happened. Before I let God in that area of my life. Brené Brown is become a pretty famous writer, especially in the leadership space. And she talks a lot about vulnerability and how important vulnerability is for us to lead other people well or for us to be who we really are in the world. And one of her quotes I really like says this. She says, courage is a heart word. The root of the word of courage is cor, the Latin word for heart. In one of its earliest forms, the word courage meant to speak one's mind by telling all one's heart. This is real courage, to get at the heart of something and to be able to open up your heart even as that feels very vulnerable and to bare your entire self, tell your entire heart to someone. This series that we're coming back to now, if you were with us back sort of the beginning of the summer, a few weeks ago, we started this series. This is part four. And if you want to go back, you can catch up on the first three parts. But we're calling it a heart-to-heart. And today, what I want to talk about is opening up our heart, the deepest part of us, being vulnerable and having the courage to open up our heart to God's heart. Nothing hidden. Nothing covered over, nothing diminished, nothing exaggerated, but to be able to go before God and say, I want to tell you everything that is in my heart. I want to have real, true courage, because here's why I think that's so powerful. I think that when we open up our entire heart to God, we will find His. We will get heart to heart. When we allow ourselves to be vulnerable and intimate, we'll find that He's already waiting for us there, ready, open arms, open heart to engage us right where we are. And if you really want to find the heart of God, if you really want to experience God's presence deep in your life, I think one of the most powerful ways we can do that is to open up ourselves with everything that we are, even the stuff that we're not proud of, the stuff that we wish wasn't there, the thoughts, the regrets, the attitudes, the actions, that we so often try to cover up to say, God, I want to come to you heart to heart, courageously opening up my heart to speak my entire mind, my entire heart to you. You ready for that? I guarantee you it will be powerful. I guarantee you that it will be worth it. And I guarantee you that it'll be difficult. We're looking at this story of King David. He was described as, in the scriptures, as a man after God's own heart. And we started this series a few weeks ago by seeing some of the different things he did. And some of them were amazing and brave and powerful and wonderful. This warrior that went out and did, you know, he's known as David of David and Goliath, slaying the giant when nobody else would step up. We all have also seen that his life, although had some incredible highs, hit some incredible lows, that he was not a perfect person. And today we come into another one of the most famous stories of David, and we see how far he can fall. This man after God's own heart, this man who became king and who went down in history as one of Israel's greatest king, how far he could fall. And we see in the first few verses that we'll look at today how fast he can fall. So if you have a Bible and you want to join me, 2 Samuel chapter 11, we're going to read this story this morning together. And just look at how this man of God's own heart deals with a time in his life where his heart seems so far from God's heart. 2 Samuel chapter 11, it says, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab, his servants, and his servants with him, and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Spring is the time in this culture, in this part of the world, in this time, when people went to battle. Because in the winter, which in this region was really more, we think of winter as really cold and snowy, their winter is more the rainy season. And so it rains and it rains and it rains and everything gets soaking wet and it becomes extremely difficult for military personnel to travel and to have, you know, the different vehicles they would have had, they would have kind of pulled along, would have been extremely hard. And so spring was the time when if you had beef with somebody else, you went to war. The kings would go to war. You couldn't really do it in the winter. So springtime, you just knew if we're going to fight, this is the time of year that we're going to fight. And so you'd go up against your enemies and that's what happened. You would go to war. That's what's happening with the people of Israel. And that's where your king was supposed to be. Your king's job is to go and fight for the people and to protect his people. And so in the spring, the kings are supposed to go out with their military and to make sure that they're winning battles and protecting their nations, to protecting their people. And we have this incredible statement right here at the beginning of this story that is huge foreshadowing for what's about to happen. Here goes out to battle all the people of Israel, all the servants, the armies, they're out there. But David remained at Jerusalem. The king who's supposed to go out and fight for and fight with his people stays in Jerusalem, stays where it's comfortable, stays where there's no threat, stays when everybody else goes, stays when you're supposed to go. And we get the foreshadowing of this, that David has an integrity problem. He's got a heart problem. He's not where he is supposed to be. Now, when we read this, we're going to come to stuff where you're going to say, man, David does some things that are bad. He is guilty. But we need to understand that this is written in a culture where bigger than guilt or innocence is honor and shame. So we think in our culture, in kind of, you know, 2019 Western world, we think very much in right or wrong, guilt or innocence, especially when it comes to legal matters. In this culture, what would have been a bigger deal is not, did I do something wrong? Am I guilty? But it would have been, how do my actions bring upon myself, my family, my nation, honor or shame? And so I can act honorably, do what I'm supposed to do, be integrity. And even if I lose the battle, at least I was honorable. And people will look back at me and say, man, he was a person of integrity. He was a great king. He was a great leader, a great person in battle. Or we act in a way that brings shame upon ourselves, our families, our nation. You do the things that don't uphold your values, and that reflects the way that people think of you, the way that people treat of you. And that is probably really the biggest concern here. We will think a little bit in terms of guilt or innocence, but in the background of this story is, what is the honorable thing to do for the king of the nation? What's honorable, or what will bring shame upon him? We already have the hints here. David remained in Jerusalem. not the most honorable thing to do. Oh, is he guilty of something? Maybe not. But is he the honorable king? Doesn't really look like it yet. Verse 2. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Now understand, this is not an uncommon thing. This is where baths would be, on top of kind of flat roofs of people's houses, and that they would go at a certain time, usually not the hottest point of the day, but they would go and they would bathe. That this woman is doing probably what most women would have done. But here's David, and he sees her from the palace. Verse 3, and David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. He sees her, then he sends messengers, and they come back, and we get more hints of this honor-shame thing. They go, hey, isn't she married? Don't you know who she is? She's the daughter of this guy, and she is the husband of that guy, Uriah the Hittite. Again, something dishonorable is happening here. And even his advisors, his messengers, he doesn't seem to care who knows about it. He's sending people out on their own and, hey, come report to me. And they're coming back saying, don't you understand that this is not a dishonorable thing to do? Don't you know her family? Don't you know the man that she's married to? Uriah the Hittite. Why is it even important that we know who he is? We find out at the end of the book of 2 Samuel, Uriah the Hittite is named as one of David's mighty men. The Hittites in general, they were a people that were in this region before the Israelites came, and some of them actually remained and became part of the Israelite community. They were known as great warriors. Uriah is mentioned as one of the mighty men at the end of 2 Samuel. The mighty men were basically like a group of great fighters. They would go out and they would do the really dangerous missions. They were thought to be, you know, they're kind of like Navy SEALs. Like when we really need to get the job done, we go to the mighty men. When David, before he was king, was fleeing for his life and Saul was trying to kill him, his mighty men, the mighty men, actually showed up, risked their own life, and saved David's. Then David becomes king. He becomes in charge of these mighty men. Uriah the Hittite is one of them. David, in a sense, owes his life to Uriah the Hittite and the other mighty men. And here, what is he doing? This guy saved his life, and he's going after his wife. And you can see, again, the dishonor in that being pointed out. Don't you know that's Uriah's wife, a guy that would put his life. Man, that guy is filled with honor. Don't you understand who Uriah is? He's sacrificing. He's out there fighting now. By the way, David, he's on the battlefield where you are not, where you would not go, sacrificing himself. He would give his life for you. He's already proved that. And here you are. You want his wife? David goes ahead. He lays with her. She becomes pregnant. We read that she had purified herself from her uncleanness. That's just put in there to be proof that this could not be Uriah's child. It's definitely David's child. He's impregnated this woman. Oh, man, and we see in five quick verses, how far a man like David can devolve. This great king, this great warrior, has this great calling in his life, and in just five verses, he's up, he's walking around, he sees this woman, he's told that he shouldn't do this, you know, implicitly. And he goes ahead. When faced with his sin, we're at this is a pinnacle moment of this story in this chapter as we get to the end of verse 5. He's made this huge mistake. And when David is faced with his sin, he has the choice to confess it or to conceal it. Here's the moment. It's happened, right? Quick. The storytelling is fast. We don't hear, oh, and then David really mulled over and he thought, oh, I'm being tempted, but I shouldn't give in and back. We don't get any of that. It's just really quick, five verses. He's made a mistake and he's made a big mistake. And there are seemingly big consequences ahead. And this is the choice he has. When faced with his sin, David has the choice to confess it or to conceal it. And here's the truth about all of our lives, because all of us have made mistakes. All of us hurt other people. All of us do things that hurt ourselves. All of us do things that we know we shouldn't do. When we're faced with our sin, we have the choice to confess it or to conceal it. And maybe you've come to the point in your life at different places. Maybe you can look back and you can say, man, I can remember when I made some mistakes. I can remember when I did things I shouldn't have done. And I remember coming to a place where I had the choice. Is it time just to be out with it and confess it, or should I conceal it? Is it time to make it known, or is it time to hide it? Is it time to be real and authentic and put it out there, or is it time to make sure that nobody ever finds out? And this is a powerful, powerful decision that we have to make in our lives. Five verses that describe David's sin, the things he has done wrong. Do you know the next 22 verses are about the cover-up? Isn't that amazing? Five verses for a guy who's at the top of the food chain. He's the most powerful, most influential, most visible in his culture. And in five quick verses, here's how far he could fall. He committed adultery. Well, let's go a little bit further. He probably committed rape. This woman had no choice. She can't say no to the king. He sends messengers. They bring her to the palace. It's not like this is a consensual thing. In five quick verses, we see how far he could fall. And interesting enough that in this story, and how incredible it is that someone that high up can go that low, we just get five verses of it. And then we get 22 verses of the cover-up. Because this is such an important decision that we have to make. When face to face with some of the most darkest part of who we are, will we choose to confess it or conceal it? David chooses to conceal it, and we see it get worse. Verse 6, so David sent word to Joab. He's now realized, okay, I did this thing, and now I realize that it's going to become known. Not just that I've done something that can bring shame upon me and upon our nation, but I'm not going to be able to hide it for long unless I do something. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. So sends to the front lines of the battle. Uriah comes back. Verse 7, when Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. This is good. I just impregnated your wife. Hey, how's it going on the battlefield? Everything going okay? This is part of the cover-up, right? Why did you send for me? Well, I just want to know how battle's going. How's your commander? How's the other people? Are we doing well? Are we winning? Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord and did not go down to his house. So here's David's plan. Hey, you come on in. I'll ask you how the war is going. You think that's why I called you in. How's the battle going? Oh, we're doing okay. We're a little up. We're a little down. Whatever it is. Great. Well, while you're here, Uriah, go home. Wash your feet. That's a strange thing, eh? Hey, while you're home, wash your feet. This is probably a euphemism. Go home and be with your wife. Actually, not uncommon in Hebrew literature, like this is, that feet are actually used as a euphemism for something more. So go home, be with your wife. While you're here, why not? Go be comfortable, sleep in your own bed. Verse 10. And Uriah doesn't go. Verse 10. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house. David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. I love it. Let's just rub it in. David, you're supposed to be out fighting where I was out fighting. And while I was fighting, you're with my wife. Now Uriah comes back and David goes, now go be with your wife. And Uriah, who is fully within his right to legitimately and righteously go and be his wife, says, I will not do that thing. These people are at war. Joab, the commander, by the way, David, you're not out there, but Joab's out there. His servants are out there. All of Israel is out there. The Ark of the Covenant is out there. What's that? That's where God's presence is concentratedly living. We're at war. I can't come home and go be with my wife and eat and drink and take it easy. That is not the honorable thing to do. And here now, we realize that this story, which is often called the story of David and Bathsheba, is really the story of David and Uriah, because we are seeing a powerful contrast. The one who is supposed to be honorable king is at home and is running around with other people's wives. And then here's Uriah courageously out there fighting. And even when he comes home, I can't be with my own wife because everybody else out there is fighting. The honorable thing to do is to be in solidarity with them. I will not take the easy way out. And so we see this rising contrast showing the shame of David, showing the honor of Uriah. And people who interpret this, scholars, they have two different ways of looking at it. Some of them believe that this is just all kind of in the background and Uriah is such an honorable person that the contrast is struck. Other people think at this point Uriah knows exactly what's happening. And on purpose, he's doing those things to rub in to David. I'm not giving you an out. I'm not going to go home so that you can just, you know, say, oh, yeah, oh, no, it must have been Uriah's kid. He came home and got her pregnant. And so some people think Uriah knows exactly what's going on, but will not give David an out. Verse 12, then David said to Uriah, remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next, and David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord, but he did not go down to his house. So now David goes, oh man, this guy is so virtuous. He won't even go home. He won't be with his wife. He won't give me an out. Everybody's going to think I did this. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get him drunk. And do you know what he finds out? That Uriah is more virtuous than drunk than David is sober. I'll get him drunk. Of course he's going to go home. Of course. And a drunk Uriah is more virtuous than a sober David. Drunk Uriah comes out and he goes, I'm still staying here. I'm still staying honorable. The plan doesn't work again. David, even sober, this powerful king, supposed to be so honorable, being shamed by Uriah. Verse 14. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him, and he may be struck down and die. David sends Uriah back to the battle with his own death warrant in his hand. Hey, Uriah, can you deliver this note back to your commander? Don't read it. And so here Uriah, his virtuous soldier, takes his own death warrant back and hands it to his commander as he goes out. And you just see that what was really, really, really bad is becoming worse and worse and worse as the cover-up continues. David feeling like, I have to do something to get rid of this guy. I have to do something to clear my name. Verse 16, and as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell, died. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, when you have finished telling the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises and if he says to you, why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Nobody knows how to say that. Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Tabez? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. Okay, this is an interesting little story. So, The commander, Joab, does what David tells him to do. And in the process, a bunch of soldiers are killed. they go to this dangerous spot where he probably wouldn't have normally gone, and there's a bunch of casualties. And so he sends word back, and he says, if David gets upset that we've lost men, David gets upset, hey, why did you do this? This seems like a bad tactical error. And then he brings up this story of this guy named Abimelech. So Abimelech, we read this story earlier on in Scripture, not a great guy. He sort of stole power. This is in the book of Judges. He stole power by killing a bunch of people, and he was kind of a rotten guy. And he went out to fight against this city, and as he was doing it, they're besieging a city. There's a big tower in the middle of it, and the people that they were fighting against run up the tower, and Abimelech just proceeds to go further and further and further. He's going to try and burn the tower down. So he goes right next to the tower. And he realizes, you know, we realize after reading it, that this is impulsive. He's gone too quickly. He didn't pay attention. It's not a good tactical move. And so when Abimelech gets right up to the wall, he's trying to burn down this tower. A woman takes this giant millstone and drops it on his head. And then Abimelech, he's injured, he's lying there, realizes he's about to die. He calls to one of his soldiers and says, take your sword and run it through me, kill me, because I don't want my reputation to be that I was killed by a woman. Which is amazing, because now we get to this story, and what is his reputation? He was killed by a woman that threw a millstone on him. Didn't really work. Needless to say, Abimelech is a sleazeball. Abimelech is not a good tactical person. Abimelech is someone that raced too impulsively into the front of the lines and gets killed. And now, that story is brought up. And he goes, hey, if David gets upset and says that we're kind of like that and we've been too, we haven't paid attention, we've done something too dangerous, we've done something impulsive and kind of in the memory, just like Abimelech. If he says that and he gets upset that we've lost people, people have died on our side because of this, you tell him that Uriah is dead. In other words, you tell David that these people are dead because of what you were doing to Uriah. You pushed us. You asked us to go somewhere unsafe. You asked me to put him in harm's way. And as a result, not only did he die, but other people died too. The shame mounted on David. It's getting worse and worse and worse. We're covering up one wrong thing with another and another and another, and now people are dying. And so Joab sends him back. If he gets mad that our soldiers are dying, tell him it's his fault. Because he told me to kill Uriah. So I just did what I was being told to do. We find that cover-ups are acts of cowardice. Cover-ups are what we do when we're too afraid to confess. And I think we find in our lives, similar to what we see in this story, is that sometimes our wrongdoing can happen in a really short amount of time, and the cover-up can last way too long and hurt way too many people. And it's not that what David did, his original sin with Bathsheba, was good, or that we should minimize it, but to look and say, man, in five quick verses, we see something terrible. But then we see the sin go on and on and on, deeper and deeper, more and more pain. The story continues. Because he was too afraid to stop it. He was too afraid at the end of verse 5 to say, I've done something wrong, I need to own up to it. What would the consequences be? I'm not sure. The Mosaic law says that those who are caught in adultery, someone who is caught in adultery with someone else's wife, that both of them should be executed. Now, we should say that for the king, that's almost definitely not going to happen. They're not going to kill the king over this. What would the consequences be for David? It's more likely that he would have shame upon his reign, upon his household, upon his kingship. And in that moment, when he had the opportunity to say, this needs to end now, he chose to cover it up. I don't know if you've ever done that, maybe in a big way or a small way. Here's some of the how-tos of cover-ups, and just maybe so that you can recognize it in your own life to say, oh yeah, I've done that, and maybe you think it's not a big deal. We deny. I didn't do anything wrong. Let's just forget about this. Sometimes we deny it to ourselves. We just try and convince ourselves, that didn't happen. I didn't do that. I wasn't in the wrong. Let's just move on. Sometimes we diminish. It's not that big a deal. Everyone else does it. I can stop whenever I want. there's worse sins than this. Oh, this isn't worse than something else. And so it doesn't really need to come out. We don't really need to deal with it. We distract. We blame. We blame our circumstances. Well, I only did that because you don't understand the kind of pressure that I was under. I only did that because that person did this to me. Or we just fully blame somebody else. I didn't do it. They did it. I'm not in the wrong. They're in the wrong. Everybody's done all these things to me. I'm the victim. And we distract from our part. And listen, by the way, sometimes that's true, especially in things where it's very relational and we hurt each other. It's very often, almost always, maybe there's wrong on both sides. But we like to really shift the blame, don't we? Just kind of shift it over as much as we can on the other side. I didn't do anything. It's not my fault. You hear what they said, what they did, how they reacted. And we like to distract from what our part in hurting other people is by blaming. Well, what about what they did? What about what they said? What about what they think? And these are all ways that we try and cover things up. And do you know why we cover things up? Because we're afraid of consequences. Isn't that it? When you've ever in your life had those moments where you go, I'm not going to be out with this. I'm not going to confess. I'm not going to share with somebody. I'm not even going to tell God what's really in my heart. Do you know why? Because we're afraid of consequences. David, afraid of consequences. What's going to happen when people find this out? What's going to happen when this gets out? What's going to happen when this is my label? And here's the truth. The consequence of concealment is condemnation. The consequence of confession is conversion. And here's what we've done. We've convinced ourselves of the opposite. The consequence of concealment, of hiding our sin, hiding the things that we should not have done, is condemnation. Condemnation is a declaration of guilt. This is what many of us are scared of, to say this was wrong, this was bad, this should not have happened. Where does condemnation come from? It comes from other people. It comes from our consciences. But a lot of us, we're just afraid. And we conceal. And what we think is that our concealing of our sin helps us to move forward, when really, it holds us back deep within who we are, deep within our soul. It eats away at us. The consequence of confession is conversion, which is we are now in a place where we can actually grow, where we can actually change, where we can actually be different people. But we flip those around, and here's what we've thought, that the consequence of confession is condemnation. If I just tell God, other people, the person that I've hurt, what I've really done, we think we're going to be condemned. We think that's going to be our identity. We think for in some ways that's going to be the end of us. Once people know, once God knows, once I really own up to it, even to myself, I'm going to be condemned. Really, the consequence of concealment is condemnation. When we hold things deep within our soul that shouldn't be there, that are hurtful towards us, that are against the kind of life that God has for us, that hurt other people, that is a cancer to our souls. It's killing us slowly. But the consequence of confession puts us on a ground where we can be converted. I don't mean that just in the sense, although it's true, of I became a Christian. I mean converted to be a different person, to have real life transformation happening in our world, in our lives. This is how we allow God to move in our lives and to grow us. We need to be willing to change. And if we're going to change, we have to start by being willing to confess. So this is where it ends. No cover up. To be courageous. Here's what's in my heart. Before God, to be willing to say, God, I've offended you. I've hurt you. Before the ones that we've hurt, to go to them and say, this is what I've done. This is what I've thought. And I'm sorry. For some of us, these are things that, man, we feel are just very personal and are just about us, but we need to get them off our chest. For you, maybe it's a step to go and confess to someone that you really trust. I'm not saying you have to broadcast this, put it on your Instagram, here's my worst sins, but to go find someone that can reassure you of what God will do when you confess. Because some of us have been convinced that confession leads to condemnation. If this gets out,
It's the worst thing that could happen to me. I'm just going to have to live in that guilt. When the truth is, a confession leads to conversion. So that's my challenge to you. I know it's going to be hard, but to ask yourself with courage, what needs to change? What needs to change now in your life for you to be a different person, for you to grow, for you in a year or a month or 5 years or 10 years to be the kind of person that you want, to have the kind of character that you want? And I get it. It's threatening. You might think, if this comes out, I don't know how it's going to affect my marriage. I don't know how it's going to affect my friendships. I don't know how it's going to affect my spiritual life. Listen, what needs to change now? Because the things that we hide, the things that we conceal are a cancer to our soul. What needs to change? That's the thing you need to confess. Confess to God. Confess to the one you've hurt. Confess to someone that you trust. Here's what we'll find, because I know that's threatening. I know that seems so hard. I know that the consequences just seem maybe unbearable in some circumstances, that if anybody finds out about this, or if that person finds out about this. But let me read to you from John chapter 3, the message of Jesus. The most famous verse in the Bible, speaking of Jesus: "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life." And then the next verse, not nearly as well known: "For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him." Jesus has not come to find out all the bad things that you've done and to condemn you for them. He's come to save you from them. Confession opens up your heart to meet the heart of God, and there you'll find a God who's been willing to send his son to die for you, not to condemn this world, but to save it. What we feel is most threatening for Christians is actually the most safe thing you can do, to open up your heart to the heart of God. Are you willing? Because if you won't change, then you can't grow. Heavenly Father, today I pray that you would give us courage, real courage to open up our hearts, to be vulnerable. God, I pray for some of us who have maybe been carrying around sin in our lives that is detrimental to our lives, sin that has offended you, sin that has hurt other people, and sin that hurts ourselves. God, I pray that today would be a turning point. I pray that today our verse 5 would look different than David's verse 5. That this would be a moment where we're willing to open ourselves up to you, and that there we would find that you don't ignore our sin, but you forgive it. That you will deal with it. That you will help us to move forward, to change, and to grow. But God, we need the courage deep within our hearts. God, would you show to anyone here today, anybody listening online, your incredible grace? Would you impress upon our hearts how powerful the cross is, that there we see how far you are willing to go to deal with sin, that you sent your son not to condemn this world, but to die for it and to save it. God, may we find forgiveness and grace and love. God, would you help us in those moments to take on the consequences that come from our sin? And yes, we know there will be those consequences, but to find something much deeper, to find that you'll walk with us and that you'll change us and restore us, and continue to make us into the kind of people that you created us to be. God, thank you that it's available, and what seems to be the most threatening for us is actually the safest thing for us to do, to run into your heart with our hearts and to find their love and grace and forgiveness. For that, we praise you, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts.